Okay, welcome to Movie Dudes, episode 204. I am Jeff, joined as always by Chris.
That's me.
And we got a fun week, I think. We got a couple of new movies, and then we're going to finish up our series review, rewatch of Final Destination. And if we have some time, we even have more stuff after that. Honestly, I've seen like probably like 10 movies in the last week, but... Yeah, you know, we only have about an hour.
Yeah, we don't got a ton of time.
And you know, I don't think people really want to hear my thoughts on, you know, Hateful Eight rewatch. It's good. Tarantino rules. Let's get right into it, Chris. And we're gonna start with a movie that I actually kind of want to see, and I've heard a lot of rave reviews of. Well, mostly rave reviews of. It has a new Seth Rogen film called Long Shot. You actually got to go see it. Tell me.
So it's a romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know why I didn't picture that going in, but I thought it'd be more of a political comedy, but it's more there's some politics in there, but it's more Dave than anything else.
Okay.
Do you remember Dave?
I remember Dave. I haven't seen it, but
like Sigourney Weaver and like so. Anyway, Seth Rogen plays this very politically charged left-wing writer, Fred Flarsky. He's kind of a mess. Like he doesn't dress very professionally. He doesn't look very professional. His writing is a little can be offensive at times. Like some of his articles are like. I'm just making one up here, but it's like suck a bag of dicks, Republicans. Like that's the title is like that's his type of writing, right? Like
you said he's right wing or left wing?
He's left wing.
Okay.
Very left wing.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Charlize Theron plays Charlotte Field, who is the Secretary of State, the current Secretary of State. And she is visioning herself for a run for president, especially after the president, the current president, President Chambers, played by Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah, I heard that.
In a hysterical role. Like he is great. He plays a guy. He plays an actor who played the president on television.
Do they identify him as Republican or Democrat?
No, but I think it's kind of. He seems like a moderate Democrat. Like she doesn't seem like a Republican. Like she definitely seems a little more to the left, like than what you would expect from like a Republican side of things.
Okay.
And so I assume since she's working for Odenkirk in a very prolific position and he is also just probably like more like middle of the road Democrat, but he is very much like he has no opinion on anything really. Like he's kind of just like, I played the president on TV. How hard could it be? And like he won the election. As it turns out, like her marks are all high except for the fact that like her humor is considered a little bit low. She just happens to run into Fred at this gala, and she actually used to babysit for him, like just like a couple years older, but like one of those situations. So she knows him. She finds out he's a writer. She happens to look up some of his stuff, and in the need for a new speechwriter that can do some comedic stuff and at least you know make it punchy. She thinks he's the good fit, so she brings him onto the team. And from there, like this slow burn romance starts to kind of happen, and it plays out kind of how you expect it to. It's a Seth Rogen film, so there's the obligatory drug scene, which is actually pretty good. There is, there's a lot of like sex jokes. There's a scene very reminiscent of Something About Mary.
jizz.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a cum scene that plays particularly into the film at the end, like to the climax of the film. It is a cute film. When it hits, when the jokes hit, it is really good. When they don't, it feels a little long. Like it's a 2 hour, 5 minute comedy. That's like when it's not firing on all cylinders, and it's hard to, like, comedy's hard, and to do it for over 120 minutes, that's really hard. There's going to be some slow parts in a film like this, but they drag, and it feels like it. Like, I don't normally get up in the middle of a film to, like, go to the bathroom or go get something to drink or anything, and, like, halfway through this, it's like, this is not moving anywhere right now. I got up and got a drink. Came back, it was fine. Like, it doesn't have, like, that breakneck pace. It gets a little slow in parts. And I don't know. I enjoyed it. It was not amazing. But I think, like, the funny stuff in it is going to be really funny. It makes some weird statements maybe towards the end of the film. O'Shea Jackson Jr. plays Fred's best friend, Lance. And there's some revelations about him, and then there's, like, revelations that, like, hit Fred and, like, his extreme left wing approach. Like, maybe this isn't the exact way to go, but
I that's gonna piss me off.
I think you'll, like, they take hits at the right people. Like, there is like, Andy Serkis plays this guy, Parker Wembley, who is basically like Rupert Murdoch. And he has played, like, a supreme jizz bag, like, scumbag. Like, they hit the right notes. It's just there's this revelation about Lance that's like, okay. And you could see it coming, too, like, where it hits. And it just kind of throws Fred into this disarray for a little bit. And it's like, I don't know if that was necessary in the film, but
I feel like I could guess. I feel I don't want to, like, get into it, but yeah, I feel like I get where you're going with what you're
saying. Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't want to spoil it. Like,
yeah,
I feel that is a scene that you could maybe dial back. You don't need it. Like, this is already a long film,
or just leave out because it's a secondary.
Yeah, it's not important. Like, it is an important piece to get him to realize that his always me approach isn't maybe the best way. Like, he's not thinking about, like, they're you know, it's a romantic comedy, so there's obviously going to be something that splits the two apart, and they have to
get back. Of course. Yeah.
So there's this thing that splits the two apart, and she has come up with a solution to how to fix that, and he doesn't want anything of it because he thinks it's against his principles, and he has to have, you know, this pep talk with his buddy Lance, which that's where things get revealed. So it's like, I understand why, like, you need to kind of push it that way, to the key is so, like, horse blinders, but it just felt a little like, all right, like, you had to hit that both sides debate.
And I understand the sentiment, but it's just, this is just my opinion, like, from where I've come from politically, it's like, that is just so not the time for that message. Like, it's not both sides. But that's me giving you my own personal opinion. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. So I liked it. It's fun. I'm going to give it a 3. It's probably a good date movie if your date can stomach some extreme, like, body humor comedy. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it's not... I don't know. This is probably not a first date film for people, but it's a Seth Rogen film. So if you've seen his other shit, you know what you're getting into. So
I remain interested, just mainly because I don't love every Seth Rogen movie, but I like him as a writer. And I generally have liked, you know, so I'm looking at some of his filmography here, and some of the stuff I would have thought he wrote, he didn't, which is surprising to me. Like The Night Before, I really enjoyed that one. I figured he wrote it. No. Anyways, well, Chris, I will check that out at some point. I actually might go to the theater to see it just because I like romantic comedies. And like I said, I like him. But if you want to see a pure politics movie, I have the one for you. It is called Knock Down the House. It is a documentary that just released on Netflix. It's directed by Rachel Lierz, which I don't know if she's like, I don't know if this is her first, you know, feature documentary. I do know that she started working on this film immediately after Trump was elected, and she was kind of like wanted to follow some, you know, female politicians who are trying to get into politics. And the idea of this movie is she's following around four different women who are running for Congress, running for, you know, the U.S. House of Representatives in the 2018 election. And specifically, it's people who are anti-establishment, you know, people who don't accept corporate money and stuff, like basically outsiders trying to break in. Right.
Right.
And boy, oh boy, you know, every once in a while, for my money, the best type of documentary is the kind where they just follow stuff around as it happens. You know, you catch something, you capture something as it's happening, as opposed to, you know, if I were going to make a documentary today about something that happened 20 years ago and I get a whole bunch of people to interview.
A talking head documentary instead of an action documentary.
Yeah, it's two different things. And for me, the observational documentary is king. It's the best. It's you know, you're capturing something as it happens, and you could edit it into a way to make it feel like a dramatic film.
Right.
And this is one of those cases where she just got so lucky by picking the right people here.
Yeah, that's what I was about. Does she kind of explain how she goes about picking some of these people? It's like,
no,
she hit on like the hottest name in politics right now, pretty much. Like,
yeah,
it's like that. They found that like a little weird.
She doesn't impose herself into the film at all. You don't hear anything about the filmmakers, how they got this started, anything. It literally plays like a dramatic film.
Okay.
So the four politicians that she follows, or aspiring politicians that she follows, are Paula Jean Swearengin, Cori Bush, Amy Villela, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, you know, I'm going to be upfront and say I'm a huge, huge fan of hers. And I, you know, bold prediction, I think she has a very, very bright future in politics. Anyways, this is following her from like the beginning of like 2018, which is also insane. To see that, like, literally nobody knew who she was, and she was talking to a room of like five people a year ago. It's just like mind blowing how much your life can change and how much politics can change in that time.
She's now basically the like scapegoat for everything wrong with America on Fox News.
Yeah, and a hero to the left. Like, and that's, you know, not plucked from obscurity. She, you know, she earned it. And, you know, as one of these movies where you have access to these people and you're following them around, you know, you're going to capture some very intimate and very, you know, stunning kind of moments. And there are parts in this that I'm just like, wow, I can't believe you got this on camera. This is great stuff, you know. Even like kind of fun moments too. Like there's a part kind of early on where AOC is, she goes to a debate, and Joe Crowley, the incumbent Democrat, he sends one of his employees to debate her. And this employee, I think it's an employee. It's something like that. He sends somebody, like he sends a surrogate to debate.
Right, not him. He didn't show up.
Yeah, you get the impression that it's like his secretary or something. And she's just woefully unprepared to debate someone who's actually there to debate. Things like that. There's, you know, I don't want to spoil anything big, but you know, there's a defeat that happens here that is just devastating. You know, I wouldn't be surprised a lot of people cry at one of the people who lose. Spoilers, not everybody wins here. You know, obviously we know AOC wins. If you follow politics real close like me, you might know some of that, what the outcome of some of the others. I knew about what happened with Paula Jean Swearengin, who was running it up against Joe Manchin, just because Joe Manchin is not a well-liked Democrat. So I knew like what the outcome of what that one would be. But even knowing all the outcomes, knowing AOC is going to win, doesn't make it any less satisfying to watch. And I will make this challenge to anyone who watches this. You don't have to be a big AOC fan or not. If you're not like, I'm almost getting choked up. If you're not like emotionally moved by the final scene of this film, you got ice water in your veins. Especially if you're kind of a dork like me and you really kind of like believe in democracy in America, like this one's going to send an arrow right to your core. It's really powerful stuff. And, you know, it's not a movie. It's about, you know, modern politics, but it, you know, manages to be about modern politics while also almost never mentioning Trump, which is great. In fact, one of the few times he's mentioned at all in the movie is AOC mocking her opponent. She holds up an ad that he sent out to his constituents where he's like, fighting Trump in D.C. It was basically the ad. She's like, that's your message? You're just fighting Trump? What are you for? You know? Right. And, you know, she's right. She won. I don't want to go on. I could probably talk about this and bore the shit out of anyone listening to death, but I really, really like this movie a lot. I recognize that some of it is because I'm a political junkie, but if you are as well, you should definitely watch this. But I think there's more than enough here, even if you're not, to enjoy this as a documentary and as a dramatic film. And honestly, it might kind of turn you on to politics a little bit. And, you know, you might see that not everyone's corrupt. You know, some people who are fighting to get in there, these were just regular people. Like, all these people who ran were basically regular people, which is kind of amazing. Like, you know, very early on, you're seeing AOC, you know, grabbing buckets of ice at work in the bar she works at. It's just like, wow, dude. So anyways, I think this film's great. It's on Netflix. It's in under an hour and a half, 86 minutes. It's a
time frame.
Yeah, it's a must watch in my opinion, and it's honestly I think the first great film of the year. I'm giving it a 5.
All right.
Don't want to belabor it too long, but again, highly recommended. Go see this. Are you ready for this, Chris?
Yeah, let's get this shit over with.
So as you'll recall, if you listened a couple weeks back, I kind of sprung on us during the week. So it wasn't planned, but I sprung it on Chris. I had been planning it for a while. But I randomly was like, hey, Chris, we got nothing coming. Let's watch the Final Destination movies. We watched and reviewed the first three, 2 weeks ago? We liked them enough that we said, you know what, let's round out this franchise. Let's finish it up and watch 4 and 5.
Yeah.
Now, Part 4 is also available on Netflix. So 1 through 4 are all available on Netflix. It's something I did not realize at first. And Part 4 is actually called The Final Destination. And just to avoid any confusion there. And that is, it's from 2009.
Yes.
I'm just looking at the Wikipedia. 2009 American 3D supernatural horror film. Mm-hmm. Written by Eric Bress and directed by David Ellis. I guess it released in August 28th, 2009. Budget of $40 million. Box office of $186 million. And according to the Wikipedia, it is the highest growing Final Destination film in the franchise.
I mean, considering the fact that this was 3D and 3D like falsely inflates the box office, I'm not surprised.
There's that. I think also that, you know, this entry, you know, coasted in on the reputation, I think, of the first three.
For like, sure.
no matter what you think of 2 and 3, I think 1 is a good film, and you know, 2 and 3 were generally kind of well regarded as at least fun, I think, by most people. So I think, you know, this franchise had like a built in fan base at this point.
Yes.
Including me among them. I remember at the time I didn't love 3, but I was like, I was into this franchise, so you know, I'm excited to see this. And you know, I'll just get it right out there. Well, let's the setup for this one is it's the same as all of them. There's a fucking disaster at the beginning and death's coming for them.
Yep.
I'm gonna get it right out there and say I think this one's the worst of the bunch, and it feels like borderline straight to video. I don't know. What about you, Chris?
Yeah. I mean, aside from the fact that the 3D now, 10 years removed, seems goofy as shit.
Yeah.
And it is very much in that vein of like, you know, hey, 3D has made a comeback. We are, you know, we're gonna make this work for us. There's a lot of it. But even outside of that, I don't think that the opening is particularly good.
It's bad.
Then, yeah.
I mean, we can get into that, but go ahead.
And then there's like goofiness throughout the film. Like, and it's not that the other films don't have like fun, goofy, like stuff going on in them, but this one, like particularly, like just feels off.
Yeah. This one, it's kind of hard to put in words either, but like also, but it's like, yeah, there's something off about this one compared to all the others. I think it honestly feels, and I'm sad to say this, it kind of feels closest to 5 to me. But boy, oh boy, when we get into 5, I think 5 is a definite improvement.
Yeah.
But like anything would be. Because look, one thing that all these movies get right, except for this one, is that the opening disaster that our characters avoid is always like something that at least a segment of the population is really scared of. I feel like they all touch on huge fears of mine. Like, I always freak out when I'm going over a big bridge. I do. I feel like nervous about it.
They're all believable. Like,
yeah.
It's all things that could happen. Like, planes, like, there are malfunctions. They do crash. They're, like, explosions
bridges
do, happen.
Bridges collapse, too. Bridges
collapse. Roller coasters have faults. Like, there are accidents. Car crashes happen. Shit that happens at a sporting event, regardless of whether it's NASCAR or not, isn't real. Like, you don't really have like that type of event. Like that's a safe place generally.
Yeah, and it's also something that people don't have a fear of because of that. Probably, you know what I mean?
It's right, like they're well-made buildings. Like,
it's like if anything, if someone has a fear to going in an event like that, it probably has to do with agoraphobia or being around big crowds of people, right, and stuff like that. But that's, I mean, that's a fear you could play off of it, but that's not what this is. Like, the opening thing here is basically just that this accident happened. I guess they were out of inspiration for stuff to come up with for an opening disaster, but it, like, I think really hurts the film, because if there's one thing that all the other movies in the series are pretty good at, is giving you that really fun, really exciting, really kind of tense and scary opening scene.
Yeah. You start to see like, you know, like they give you like pictures of like things creaking, or, you know, stuff that looks like stuff swaying, like things that, like, I don't know, is that screw going to pop out? Like, here it's like, none of this is believable. And I don't know if it's because of the way it's shot or just like that the whole concept is absurd. But none of it is tense, so it doesn't end up being this fun opening scene.
Yeah, it sucks. I think I think that this opening scene, everything about it really sucks. Like, besides the fact that on a conceptual level, it's terrible. Like, everything looks like shit. Like, bad CGI and bad 3D special effects. It's stupid. Like, it's just not believable the way things fall apart here. Like, it's just like, yeah, okay. Yeah, I don't know. And then, you know, at least in the other ones, you at least had one actor you could kind of, like, hang the movie around.
Yeah.
Here, it's just a bunch of dead-eyed idiots that you'll never see again in anything. Like, same thing with 5.
To me, like, the best, the one that I could at least latch onto the most is George. He's the security guard.
Okay. Okay.
Like, that's it. Like, nobody else has any sort of personality at all.
I gotta be honest. Like, I I didn't take notes on the movie. I just woke up one morning and started watching it. I'm like, oh, I gotta get this out of the way. And I forgot a lot of it. You know, here's what I kind of remember is that, like, it seems like just as it gets going, they're like, well, I guess we solved it. I guess it really felt like that in this one. And then after that, like, builds to this big closing sequence.
Yeah.
Which is like, I kind of look like I think that all these movies, all of them, even the best one, even part one, like, have a problem with the ending. So, like, I kind of give them credit for trying to go for this big ending here. But unfortunately, I think that ending's stupid too. Like there's this big set piece ending of, like, you know, another disaster.
Yeah, that also gets rewound, right? Like, so, like, you go through the disaster, and then it's almost like another opening sequence.
Yes.
It's like, we just spent, like, half of this film, it's these two fucking sequences. Because this is an 82-minute film. It's the shortest film in the series. And these sequences take, like, 15, 20 minutes.
So did it feel that way to you, too, where it's like, after it got started, all of a sudden they're like, well, now we're at the end. And then...
Nothing happens.
It's so weird. There's like no middle to the movie. It's just like there's the setup. There's a very brief kind of middle section where they're like, oh, we figured it out now after a couple people died. And then it just builds to the end. And it's weird. And maybe that could have worked a little better if, again, I think that the ending that they built toward is like this disaster happening in a theater, which is like, you know, I guess it's like a way to go meta, you know. You're seeing this in the theater, like, oh, let's try to make the theater scary. But, like, what fucking AMC has, like a bunch of shit going on behind the screen with, like, nails and ladders and shit? Like, it just doesn't seem... Like, is that what is, like, behind the screens at movie theaters? I didn't think that's how that
works. No!
And that's, like, the setup here is, like, there's this, like... There's, like, this fucking mousetrap shit going on behind the fucking screen.
There's almost never anything behind the screen.
I would imagine it's a wall.
Because it's a wall, but I don't know. At least for me, all the theaters I've ever been in, there are emergency exits right by the screen.
Yeah.
And they push out. Like, if you've ever gone out of one of them, they push directly out into the parking lot.
Exactly.
Nothing fucking there.
There's not this weird cartoon construction scene happening behind this screen that is somehow gonna... I forgot exactly what it does, but it, like, knocks over all these fucking nails that come flying out of the screen. And that's, like, how, like, one of the people get murdered. And then what was happening, like, everyone freaks out after that and the theater sets on fire. I don't even remember. I just remember nails fly out of the screen. I was like, that doesn't... Again, it's like, if you're gonna do these things... It makes it a lot more fun if you could kind of picture it happening. And just neither of the big set pieces here I can picture happening.
And even the regular deaths, like, so I think I'm looking at the IMDb page right now. The guy I want to talk about is called Racist.
Like, yeah.
He, like, pulls up outside of George's house. George's, he was the black security officer. The racist wife, like, dies in the explosion in the opening scene, and he holds, like, George accountable for that. I don't know why. Makes zero sense outside of, I guess, he's racist. So he shows up outside of George's house and he's gonna, like, burn a cross on his lawn or something. I don't know. And it's like the dumbest, like, fucking those fucking three idiots that, like, punch each other and
Stooges.
Yeah, it's like fucking Three Stooges nonsense where it's like, oh, he, like, the radio hits and it's like, this makes zero sense. None of this would happen. It's not like, you can see, like, that first death in the original Final Destination where he ends up, like, choking himself.
Yeah, you can almost, it stretches a little bit where it's like, oh, yeah, you'd really keep slipping on the shampoo.
Yeah.
But, like, you could see it. You can see it, maybe.
Right, like, you're panicking. It's
fucking bonkers.
They've gotten to a point where the deaths aren't believable anymore because it's just like, oh, we have to keep topping ourselves. But what made those original movies so great, like, even in, like, the second one where the guy falls down and, like, the fucking fire escape goes through his eye.
Hey,
like,
a ladder could go right through your eye, you know?
Like, shit, like, all this, like, fucking mousetrap bullshit that was going on in his apartment, but he escaped it. And it's this dumb thing that could happen to anybody is what actually ends up killing him. It's like, no, like instead they have this racist being pulled down the street by his car that has somehow set itself into drive.
I actually, now that I remember which one you're talking about here, I found this one kind of funny.
Oh, it's funny. It's just like, it is totally unbelievable. And it's like, okay, so that's what they're doing here, I guess. I don't think that was their intention.
But if you find that unbelievable, what about the one where, I thought you were talking about the one where the guy, and I guess I don't know which guy this was now, it's like, gets like knocked back into a fence, and then the fence cuts out, chunks of his back.
His name, like, according to IMDb, is Mechanic.
Okay. I mixed up the mechanic with the racist. Yeah. I apologize to the mechanics out there.
The racist had a tow truck, so
I mean,
and then like the other one that's ridiculous is the cowboy, where the fucking the bath like floods the upper level and it just drops down onto his head in the hospital. Like none of this is believable. Like it's all completely stupid.
And I think honestly with that, I think we've covered the whole movie pretty much.
Yeah, I think that's it. Because
I can't remember. Like, there might have been some other dumb twist. Like, I know, like, in every one of these, they try to, like, explain things a different way. Like I remember part three, it was like, oh, the camera is the thing. I honestly don't even remember if there was a thing to this.
I don't remember how he, like, came upon, you know.
Like, how they figured it out, or I don't know.
It's that bad. Like, I don't know. There's nothing good about this, though. It's it doesn't hold up, especially, like, I mean, I don't think it was good probably originally, but
nope,
it certainly doesn't hold up now. Like, if you're not viewing it in 3D, it kind of looks like shit. Like, a lot of the stuff flying at the screen just looks out of place and stupid.
Yeah, it's funny because we started the series, and I'm talking about Final Destination 1. I'm like, you know, that's kind of one of the best representations of the post-Scream era. It's like a great example of a post-Scream movie. It doesn't even, you know, it's kind of post-post-Scream. But then you get to like these last two and they kind of represent the worst of their era. Like these really do kind of represent like the kind of rut. I think, I mean, it's not entirely fair because at that time there was still stuff that was great coming out, like Let the Right One In and stuff. But, you know, this is like, if you want an example of really shitty late 2000s horror, this is a great example of it. And, you know, throwing in the really cheap 3D effects. You know, it's like they still do 3D movies all the time now, but they don't do the stuff flying at the camera to give you the gag. It's just, and they don't look as bad as this. I guess I'm fine with doing scores. There's nothing else I really remember that I want to talk about here.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing good. I'm going to give it a 2. I thought about a 1, but I mean,
I don't think it quite rises to that. It's just mediocre. It's just,
yeah, it's not like hot garbage. It's just like somebody like lit a bag of poop on your doorstep and lit it on fire. It's not a dumpster fire. It's just poop
it's
fire.
A bag of shit.
It's a bag of shit on fire on your step.
Yeah, I also give it a bag of shit out of 5. I'm gonna give it a 2. And I guess the less said on that, the better. We're gonna go now into the final one, which I think I have a little more to say about. It's Final Destination 5. Is also 3D, directed by Stephen Quayle, written by Eric Heiserer, and it, let's see, released in August 12th, 2011, budget of $40 million, box office of $157 million, so it's kind of similar budget and similar success at the box office, just not as much. And I will blame that one on the fucking part 4 right there.
Oh, for sure.
Now, it's funny. I want to say that this film might have been one of the very first movies we reviewed on Movie Dudes. So this is going to be one of those rare cases where we're actually re-reviewing a movie for real. And I seem to remember that when we talked about it at the time, you and I both came away pretty high on this movie, if I remember correctly. I remember I really liked this movie the first time I saw it.
I think when we first saw it, it was a fun film.
I have to say, rewatching it, it didn't hold up as well as I remember. I think a big part of why I loved it when I saw it in 2011 has to do with the ending, which we will get to. But yeah, let's dive into it kind of from the beginning. I think there's a number of improvements over 4. You could tell that they were trying here, and they realized that they... I don't know. It seems like they realized they were falling into a rut, and they had to like right the ship here. And I think they kind of almost did, but I guess not enough to like. This is the last one. So
I'm sorry. They toned down. I think the 3D nonsense to a point like that. It's like it's there. You'll see it in scenes, but it's not every single scene. They let the movie breathe and like play on its own. I do think that like the opening sequence is a bit too heavy on CG, and you almost have to be with something because it is so large scale. You would have to do it that way. And I guess like they did kind of back themselves into a corner with these, like they keep getting more and more elaborate as they go on. And at some point you're going to reach something that's so elaborate that you can't do it. Computers, but it doesn't necessarily look that great now 8 years later, but it's still fun.
I wouldn't say it looks great, but I don't think it looks like really bad. Like I think
it's terrible.
I think it's like at the time it probably looked fine, and it is aged. It's impressive, I think, for the year it came out and the budget of the film. And beyond the effects of it, like you said, it's like fun. Like it's a good opening sequence. I think like it's pretty wild, and it goes on for like seems like 10 minutes where people are just getting knocked off by this bridge in different ways. And again, like I you know, speaking to like what I said at the beginning about part 4, it's like this is something like every time I go over a bridge that big, I don't like it. I don't know about you. I'm sure some people are super used to it because they do it every day, but like I personally don't like it.
Yeah, I don't like being in like the right hand lane on a bridge, like
close
to the water. It's like, what if somebody hits me and like bumps me off the bird? I'm not a huge fan of that, and I mean that there will be something terrifying about being stuck in a traffic jam on a bridge.
So, yeah, right there, better opening. I think these kids, I mean, they're not, none of the, I don't think anyone here became bigger actor. I think the biggest actor we have here is, what's his name, Dave Koechner or whatever.
Okay.
Their boss.
Yeah.
He's from, you know, like Anchorman and shit. Also, we got Tony Todd coming back, which is a, you know, that's a welcome return. But... you know, this cast of kids, I think, is a little bit like better. I think like the lead kid here, he's a little bit better.
They have a little more charisma. Well, they have some charisma.
Yeah. I don't think they have a ton, but like they're okay.
Yeah, I mean they have a drip more than those in the Final Destination, so it plays a little bit better.
I'm kind of blanking on some of the kills.
That's one of the problems with, I think, Final Destination 5, is that they kind of spent so much on that opening scene that some of the deaths later are less impressive. There is one, though, that I really...
There's one I just found. All right, which one? There's actually two. Actually, there's two good kills in this. Like, I think really good ones. So what did you remember?
I really like the one in the warehouse where... he's the one guy, he's a kind of like a, you know, a floor manager or something. And he's talking to his employee and he ends up pushing the guy out of the way,
yeah.
But it ends up putting him right in the way of the thing, and he ends up impaled on this giant hook. And it's just this fun, elaborate, like, setup, but it plays out exactly like what we were saying we like out of this, where it's just like, it's an accident. Like, it seems like an accident, and it is believable that shit, something bad's gonna happen, and you try to help somebody and you fuck them. Like,
you know what? That wasn't one of the ones I was thinking of. The two that came to mind to me finally were the LASIK scene.
Oh, yes.
just the shot of when it's like burning into her retina, like going into her eye, is pretty fucking wild. It also kind of like, I just now reminded me of like that scene in Dead Space 2 where it's just like you're fucking with someone's eye. Fuck that. Squeamish, man. And the other one is, it's like ridiculous and stupid, but the path to it, like the ride to the end, to the punchline, is really fun. And that's the gymnast, where it's like, there's all these things going on. You don't quite know where it's going, but there's like this little thumbtack that everyone keeps almost stepping on.
It's a believable thing that, like, all right, it is this like ridiculous mousetrap type setup, but it is like, hey, if something were to happen, it may cause like X, Y, and Z. Like, you can see the progression. It makes logical sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, all right, yeah, it's totally absurd. And
I think, like, you know, when she basically some of that chalk gets kicked up and she slips off the bar, but then, like, she just lands and her body, like, cracks in half and, like, bones are sticking out. And I was just like, okay. But still, it was fun. Like, the setup was fun. That punchline's fun, even though it's stupid. Yeah. The setup was tense. Yeah. So, yeah, I think this movie's, like, I'm talking myself into almost a stronger, like, verdict here. I think that they kind of figure something. Before we get to, like, the big twist at the end, I think that the ending, so to speak, before that, is kind of one of the better ones in the movie, because I think they finally figured out a way to build to it. Like, again, we kind of talked about this, I think, last episode. It's like, you can't fight death. It's just like an invisible thing. So here they finally turn it into like one of them kind of cracks and becomes a bad guy.
Yeah.
Not 100%. Like, I didn't believe it. Like, I didn't buy this guy's turn. But it's at least like they like tried something to make a climax.
Well, yeah, it's not a believable turn by him. Like, I don't think he's a strong enough actor for that. But the progression and the, like, you can see somebody like happening like that. Like,
it's a good idea, I guess. I think.
There's a way to get out of this. If I kill somebody, I get their life.
And it's like, okay, so then there's your villain for the climax for the kids to fight, you know. And then, of course, the very ending, the big twist, the thing that made me fall in love with this movie back in the day, was, you know, we have our last two survivors, and we always have to do the final scene of the movie is, of course, they're going to go somewhere, and they don't realize it, but they're going to get killed. You know, like, death is still after them. And this time, it's them getting on a plane, they're going on a trip to Paris, and lo and behold, we're at the beginning of Final Destination 1. You know, it's the same plane from part 1, and you get to see, you know, Devin Sawa and all the other kids from part 1 getting on the plane in the background and shit. It's really, like, it's just kind of a gimmick, but it's a fun one. Like,
it's a nice, fun loop. It is, like, a little ridiculous that, like, this evidently took place 11 years prior. but it's fun. And you get to see that opening sequence from a different perspective.
Another fun thing is, you know, me watching this now, I know the twist at the end, and I was able to catch all the 90s specific references that they put in. They do put a few in there to let you know it's the 90s, you know, like the music that's playing in their cars or whatever.
Right.
Is that where you were going with that or no?
No, it's like, I mean, you just, like, I mean, you instinctively think that, like, each film takes place, you know, after when it happens, right? Like, you know, 2011, you're thinking like somewhere around there, but instead this like loops back a whole decade, and it's like, okay, I guess it's doable. Like, there's not that much has changed, but
And another thing I liked about that, you know, is that they didn't have to rely on them going, oh, this has happened before, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And another thing I do like about part five, you know, that I did notice as the movie was going is, like, it takes them longer to figure out what's going on than in any of the other films, including the first one. And that's, to me, it's more believable because in the first one, it's like, okay, you guys cracked that code all on your own because one person died after, like, right. Oh, one person died, so therefore that means death is coming for us and blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean? Like, that's not, like, a rational explanation to no. things. It's like maybe sometimes usually people just die. Logic. Yeah. And so here, I like that it took them a while to, like, piece that together. They're like, hey, you know what? Holy shit, maybe, like, we are actually all dying, and, like, why is that? Again, I'm not saying this thing's a work of art, and when I started going into this review...
Fun, though.
Yeah, when I started going into this review, I was kind of like, this thing barely kind of crosses the finish line. But, again, like, I had a lot of things that I, you know, point out as positives to this, so... That's, you know, yeah, I... You know what? Like, you could almost just watch this whole series and skip four, and it wouldn't matter. And yeah. It's probably a better recommendation. But yeah. Anyways, anything else that you wanted to say about five?
No. I think it is a fun watch. Well, like the other three that we enjoy in this series. I do think that like that. Tie back to the original is nice. It's a nice closed loop. It ties everything except for that fourth one together. So I'm not really sure where that fourth fucking film fits in anything.
It shouldn't fit straight to video. I mean, it really almost feels like it, which is weird because it's like a $40 million budget. But that, you know, that NASCAR part of the beginning looks bad.
Yeah, that's probably where all their money went too.
Yeah. And it still looked like shit. Score for five.
You have a three.
Same. You know, closing thoughts for me is I actually like really like this series. Like they're all kind of goofy. You know, none of it is very profound. You know, I think when I saw them when I was, you know, a high school kid, I did think that they were more profound and like edgy and, you know, meaningful. But I do like that, you know, there are movies that they're like about an idea at least. And they're fun. It's just a fun idea. Like traps, basically, killing kids. I kind of missed the series. I would love to see them take a stab at it and make a part six or a reboot or whatever. How about you?
Yeah. I mean, I would like to see them kind of do something new with it. I did see your recommendation for.
Did you see that? I'm not saying that's the way it has to go.
I don't know if like that, particularly the director that you'd kind of picked out there. I'm like, he makes some dour films. Like, I don't know if he would have the fun aspect to it. And that's
I know, yeah. But like, what if they rebooted it and it wasn't like fun? It was like fucking. Serious and like legit, like grim and scary.
I'm not sure.
I mean, it's something different.
Out of that, but it would be something.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm like the idea I threw out there was like, fucking give this series to Jeremy Saulnier or fucking S. Craig Zahler, which is two of like, you know, they have really really fucking disturbing violence in their films. Like, I don't think you could actually classify most of their films as horror movies, but boy, do they feel like them, you know.
I mean, at least Green Room has some, there's some levity there, right? Like,
a little bit.
Like, it is a very dour film, but there is some levity. There is some kind of jokiness that works, and he does work well with young people. So,
yeah,
maybe more him.
I would love, I mean, I would be super interested in either, but also I'd actually be interested in almost any direction they went. If they went, we're going to do a part six, I would be fine with that. We're going to do a reboot, but kind of in the same spirit, like kind of still tongue in cheek a little bit, but you know, this is gonna be fun. We're gonna have some fucking clever traps in here. I'd be fine with that if it kept the same tone, but you know, they're gonna have to somehow update it or modernize it in some way. So I think that they will bring it back at some point. You know, they made a decent amount of money. I just think it's just dormant because it just died off, and I'm probably trying to figure out exactly what to do. Call me. I got a great idea, guys.
Right. Do it.
S. Craig Zoller's Final Destination 6. It's just a bonkers thing I came up with. Man. Anyways, did you want to touch on any more, like, some of the... We saw some random stuff in this last week. Part of it, some of it was my fault. You want to touch on any of them or no?
Yeah. Why don't we save some of that for next week? I mean, we probably should talk Doomsday at some point, but...
Yeah, I made Chris... or I just kind of... You
watched it, and then it's like, I haven't seen that in a while, so I rewatched it.
Yeah, I was texting you, because, I just thought there's so many things, and I guess we'll talk about it at a future date, like, there were so many things that jumped out to me where I'm like, yeah, Chris would fucking dig this. And I texted you, and you're like, I've seen it. I thought it was all right. And I came in so strong on it that I guess you decided to give it another look.
Yeah, I was like, I was like, where the hell did he watch? And I was like, that's on Shudder. That's weird. Yeah, but, yeah. Okay.
Anyways, not to be too vague, I'll just throw it out there. It's like a Neil Marshall film from like 2008, I think it is.
Yeah.
And it's just like crazy bonkers where it's like, honestly, it feels like a mix between like fucking like Mad Max and fucking what was the other one I was saying? Like Mad Max, Resident Evil, and fucking
Underworld.
Like Aliens.
Alien. Yeah, Alien is
there. Like their vehicles look like straight out of fucking Aliens, man. Like just so many. It's you could tell he was going for like a genre mashup of like everything he loved from the 80s. Even the score, it had kind of an 80s score and all that. So, you know, that was kind of right up my alley too. But like all the movies it was referencing other than like Mad Max, I know you kind of like really dig. So I was like, man, I wonder if he's seen this. But it's funny because I ended up liking it more. I just think it's messy and insane. And I kind of wish he was doing more shit like that.
I mean, he has two movies. He's evidently attached to the next Skull Island movie. So the next movie.
I'd like to see him do like mid budget stuff, not like he just did Hellboy, which I guess was awful. Too bad. It's like he hasn't done a movie in so long. He's done some really good like Game of Thrones episodes. But yeah. It's just a director I always liked from the 2000s that I'm just like, where did this guy go? It seems like he just disappeared. This is a movie I've never seen or even heard of. And I was like, this is fucking crazy. Anyways, I guess that kind of had our little talk about it right there.
It's a movie. Go watch it.
Yeah.
It's fun.
I forgot. I wanted to mention one other thing at the end here, but already slipped my mind. Anyways. Next week, Chris? I have no idea.
I'm going to try and see Detective Pikachu. We'll see.
Oh, is that this weekend?
That is this weekend. So I don't know. I don't know if I'll get out to see it or not. It is also Mother's Day. So
there's that as
handle
well.
That shit. So. Yeah.
All right. Well, shit. I don't know. I'll have some. You know what I will have? I'm going to watch The Ranger on Shudder. It's like some new movie they threw
out. Oh, yeah. They just sent me an email about that.
Like, it has, like, a pretty high Rotten Tomatoes. So I was like, oh, I guess I'll check it out. Something new. I'll have that, I guess. And maybe something in the theater. Maybe I'll go see Long Shot. I don't know.
Sounds good.
We'll be back, though. Probably.
Movie dudes. Do-do-do-do-do.